Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Okay. Well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Taryn Southern, who's a digital artist and filmmaker, co-directing a documentary about the brain and working on her recently unveiled AI human collaborative album, I Am AI. As a YouTuber, she has produced more than 1,000 videos and garnered more than 500 million views online. So thank you very much, Taryn, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk about your projects. You've done some interesting things. The AI album you're working on, the token blockchain song, some virtual reality music videos. So before we kind of get into that and what that process looks like, I want to know kind of how you got here. So I know you grew up in Kansas, right? And that's a long way from Wichita, Kansas. Okay. So that's a long way from, living in Kansas to living in the future. So what was growing up in Kansas like, and how did you get from there to here?
It's possible growing up in Kansas spawned the desire to live in the future.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I loved growing up in Kansas. It was an awesome place to grow up, but I always felt, as young as I can remember, that there was a great big world out there that I desired to explore. And Kansas was smack dab in the middle of it. So I was always really keen on, I don't want to use the word getting out. That's not necessarily appropriate. But just exploring the world and seeing as much as the world that I could. And I did that. I went to school in Miami, which was like a really multicultural, very different place from Kansas, and really inspired me in a lot of ways to see other cultures and ways of life. And then and then I moved to LA and became involved in the dark web of entertainment. And it ensnared me. I never left. And I think at my core, I was a technologist. Just having grown up in Kansas and being one of the first generations to have access to the internet in a profound way. Like most of the stories that I read and people that I connected with who inspired me to think really big about the world were people I met online when I was 11, 12, 13, 14.
Yeah.
Sorry, mom and dad. Yes, I was hanging out in IM chat rooms. But I think it was that that connection over the internet that probably encouraged me to dive even deeper into technology and the impacts that it could have on the world. So I've always integrated it into my work.
That's interesting. I grew up, I grew up all over, but one of the places I lived when I was a teenager was in a small town in Oklahoma. And I kind of had a similar...
What town? Sort of,
It was called Pahuska, Oklahoma. It's like maybe a few thousand people at most. We had to drive to a different town to go to a Walmart, which was the big attraction in the area. I was getting online and experiencing, interacting with all these interesting kind of transhumanist futurist communities, and it was a really powerful outlet for me.
How old were you when you were doing
so? I was about 16, 17.
Amazing that that's what you stumbled upon at that age. I wasn't that far down the rabbit hole yet.
But that was, it was such an interesting thing because I both loved the environment. I loved the wide open space of that area and so much of it, but also I needed that intellectual stimulation, which, the internet helped to provide. So, so you started there, you kind of, that maybe propelled you in some ways to explore some of these other avenues. And what, like you've gone through a huge kind of interesting set of trajectories in this process, right? Like your relationship to media has gone all over the place, I think. And I think I wanted to ask you if this was true. I read I read somewhere that you in college received a grant to travel to Peru to study the use of ayahuasca among rainforest communities. So I couldn't verify that. Is that true?
True fact. True fact. Project Amazonas in Florida gave me a grant and paid for my 3-4-week-long trip to Iquitos, Peru, where I lived with rainforest communities and studied their shamanic use of ayahuasca.
Wow.
I was 19 years old.
That's amazing. And what did you, what did you learn from that, or what did you take back from that?
That was a life-changing experience. I mean, I think... So I studied anthropology in college, and it just so happened that a lot of my professors at the University of Miami came from a very long history of studying the drug trade, because of course they were located in Miami, and that's where the government, Nixon, especially during the drug era, was sending people down there to do a lot of studies. And so oddly enough, I had all of these classes on hallucinogenic drugs, but also, you know, the mainstream kind of bad drugs that we hear about. And it just became fascinating to me, probably in the same way that you're interested in transhumanism and transformation. Like the notion that people could like do this thing that suddenly makes them a different human or gives them a transformative experience. And I just had no context for that at all outside of the anti-drug PSAs in Wichita. This is your brain. Marijuana or whatever it is, you know. So it was just a fascinating topic for me, and probably I'm sure I was attracted to it just by the fact that it was so taboo.
Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, that's kind of, you know, you started out in this kind of Indiana Jones way, and then, then go out and get involved in media and all these things. So you've done a lot of different kinds of media and parody songs and all these kinds of things. What got you interested in doing things that were more kind of focused on technology and so forth?
So LA is a funny place, and I've been here for a long time now, and so my career has definitely taken some really funny, ironic twists and turns. And I think some of it is a product of being open and flexible and taking opportunities as they came. And then those things just sort of compounded. And so, as you said, like my first 4 or 5 years in LA, my career was primarily focused on comedy. I was an actress in a bunch of sitcoms, and I did these really raunchy parody videos on YouTube that I thought were hilarious at the time, because I was 23 years old, and you know, that was funny to me. But I think underneath all of that, while I was really enjoying pursuing this performance career of sorts, I was always super into technology. I mean, it was like that's been my hobby, really, is learning. And I'm just, I think Google is my greatest vice. It's just my curiosity takes me in so many different directions, which is a blessing and a curse, because I never find myself bored, but I always find myself going down the strangest rabbit holes just because I'm so fascinated by life. And so when you choose a career that's inherently very open-ended, that doesn't have a particular ladder or a set of rules, you just end up taking on these various projects that send you in funny directions. But as I got older and I had really felt that I had done the comedy thing, it had been fun, and I felt like it had kind of run its course, or at least in that iteration, it had run its course. And I was just not that inspired by it. I was like, you know what? Let's tackle some of the things that I'm intellectually curious about and see if I can turn that into a career of sorts, or manifest that into something new. And that was a conscious decision I made about 3.5 years ago.
Wow. And how do you, you know, I was a amateur musician for like 8 years, something like that. And what I've thought about a lot is how you go through like pivots, right? and what that does to your audience as you're doing it, right? What did you, like, going into that, making a decision that you were going to try this other thing, was that, I don't know, how did you think about that? Was that an intimidating idea, or was that just, were you just comfortable with it, or what?
That's a great question. It was incredibly intimidating. Mm-hmm. For one, I had actually built a sustainable career on YouTube, which hadn't, you know, that was not even a possibility 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I had this audience and I could deliver content to them every single week and they would pay attention, they mm-hmm. would watch it, and I could make a living doing that. I knew that making a big pivot would rob myself of that audience, that mm-hmm. I threatened losing everyone. But mm-hmm. this funny thing kind of happened. Like, while I was simultaneously wrestling with the notion of leaving, this was like a year and a half long decision-making process. Simultaneously, YouTube was changing its algorithms, like, in a huge way, where all of a sudden, the weekly content I was making anyway was no longer being favored. And it was clear that the content creators weren't going to be the kings there. It was going to be the advertisers. And so I actually was able to make a much easier decision, which was, I don't want my life to be imprisoned by YouTube and by this algorithm that I have zero control over. So I need to make the best decision for me and what's right for me. And it will work itself out. Even if I lose all of my livelihood, which I did, mm-hmm. I did within a matter of 5 months, you know, in terms of just losing the audience, losing the views, essentially losing everything I'd built. It's still there in numbers, but those numbers don't mean anything. So yeah, it was a really hard decision, but ultimately such a great one. I've been so pleased. You're forced to kind of figure things out. And as the world evolves around you, you find new opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think it's interesting because, you know, I forget who said this, but, talking about what, you want to do, as an artist, you want to do what your audience wants, but what your audience wants is for you to do something they don't expect, right? And so if you don't do these huge creative leaps or do new things and look for a new audience and all this kind of stuff, then ultimately you're just kind of cannibalizing something you've done in the past, right?
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Yeah. Very so true. That's huge. And so being willing to embrace that kind of pivot, that transformation, going into a new process. How did you start to conceive of what that would look like in terms of doing this AI stuff and all that kind of thing?
I mean, it's certainly morphed into things that I would have never expected. If you had told me January of last year that I'd be working on an AI album and co-directing this movie about the future of man and machine, I would have thought you were crazy. Mm-hmm. So the first iteration of it was VR and AR. Mm. I'd put on a headset and had my first experience with high-end VR content and thought, oh my gosh, this is mind-blowing. This is the future. I want to be a part of this. How do I do it? Mm-hmm. And so that was, again, born out of just natural curiosity. So I started talking to a ton of people in the VR space, going to VR meetups in Los Angeles, offering to produce VR content for free for different companies that I thought might be interesting and team up with other people in the VR world. So I spent about a year playing in the VR AR space, going to conferences, all of that, and learning how to make VR content. And then from there, I got a grant from Google to make some VR videos. I didn't know what I was going to make. And then it was about that same time that I found out I received the grant that I knew I was going to do something set in a futuristic world. Mm-hmm. And around that same time, I read an article about AI being used to make music. And I thought, oh my gosh, I should use one of these AI programs for my Google grant series.
Yeah.
I never expected to make an album, but after I started working with it, I was like, this is amazing. I have to make, I have to make music with this. And so everything kind of just morphed into the next thing. And I knew that I wanted to get really specific about narrowing in on technology as my box. Mm-hmm. You know, I think sometimes it's all too easy, or at least for me, I get so excited about a lot of different ideas. everything. And that's been part of my problem to some degree as an artist, that I've just done a lot of different things. And so giving yourself a really specific box and then trying to work within those constraints actually is a incredible creative fuel. So yeah. Creating that box has been a really good, has reined me in and been a fun creative challenge.
Mm. Yeah. Well, so what do these processes actually look like? So with the AI album, I know you used a variety of different tools. So what are some of those tools and what does that look like in terms of your creative process?
It really depends on the tool. I'm working with Watson, IBM Watson, Google Magenta, Ava, Amper, and then a few other smaller tools here and there, like Google InSynth. So it depends on the tool. I think like artists develop processes around the advantages or disadvantages of any given tool. So I'll just give you Watson, for instance. Watson's great in the sense I can feed it data. I can give it parameters. And then from those parameters, from that song data, it can learn and churn out something new. Mm-hmm. So I think of IBM Watson almost as a fun, it's almost like a fun partner that allows me to collaborate with someone who's no longer alive. Mm-hmm. So if I want to work with Beethoven or Bach or insert famous artist name, I can take that work, ingest it into the system, and then iterate as much as I want with a track. I can transpose the MIDIs into whatever instrumentation I want. I can give it any kind of modern flair that I so choose. There's still a ton of creativity. It's just that the sources of inspiration are coming from another entity and not my own brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's, you know, I think that's for musicians and artists, that's probably really controversial, right? Like this idea of using something non-human or whatever. And, you know, we've seen it with genres of music, right? EDM is specifically kind of a rejection of a sort of bias towards, you know, instruments that you actually, you know, strum
can
or
play.
Something like that. Yeah. So there's those tensions in the creative space. What do you think that looks like? Do you think, you know, in a decade, everybody's going to be doing it like this? Or do you think these are tools that are just interesting to explore, but most people won't want to adopt them? How do you think about that?
I think it's probably both of those things and more. I think it's a bit more nuanced. But like you said, EDM, that was a great example of how EDM is sort of a rejection of instruments you can play. And hip hop is another great example. When hip hop came on the scene, everyone in the traditional music industry was like horrified that all these kids were using samples and beats to make tracks. Mm-hmm. And it was because they were scrappy and that's what they had to do. And I think with AI music, it'll start out the same way. People will use it out of a sheer force function that they can't play instruments themselves. Mm-hmm. And then once they start developing a language around it, and there really is, like, it's like in working with each of these different processes, I've developed my own funky new tricks and I suppose entry points into writing music that I did not have prior to, just because these tools enabled me to think differently about the process. Yeah. So now I think about music more like a film editor thinks about editing a film as a result of this process. It's just, I just have a different perception of what I'm making and how I approach it. I think other people will come in that have other various talents that I don't have, and they'll apply their framework to it, and it will take off in its own unique direction. One of the really interesting potential use cases that will inevitably happen is just being able to easily take music and transpose it back and forth into zeros and ones and instruments really allows creative musicians a way to intersect technology with their work in a way that they probably couldn't have done on their own before. Mm-hmm. If you're a musician who can play but you can't code, some of these tools, you could get really interesting with, you know, figuring out the emotional resonance of your song and then trying to replicate some of those elements but shifting it ever so slightly so that you actually get a very specific endpoint with your audience in terms of what you want them to feel. just, I think that we will see some really creative applications that just don't exist yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tried to play around with, I guess, Amper. And I was looking at a couple of the different tools. I think Watson, I think, has an open source API you can use or something like that, right? And so there's different levels of technical skill required to do those. I think it definitely involves a different process. And like you said, it makes you feel a little bit more like a director or something like that, right? Like you're engaging in this kind of maybe a larger scale process. And I think about that. It's really interesting because putting together a movie, it seems like to me the hardest thing a human being could do, right? It's, you know, you're trying to have a creative thing and go towards a creative vision with thousands of people who are, you know, you're needing to work together and move towards this thing you can envision. Do you feel like the process for you, there's a lot of resistance from the technology, or is it pushing you forward? Like what's the sensation there?
Both. It's early. So there are certain limitations that are frustrating. Mm-hmm. I think those limitations will be worked out very quickly. Mm-hmm. And they've already, a lot of them, if you had seen what I was dealing with a year ago and now, there are some pretty big differences in what you can achieve.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty optimistic about what will be enabled over the next year to 2 years with the AI community working on music as heavily as they are.
Yeah.
And it'll just take time, right? Like, yeah. I think until people actually get in and play with all the different tools and see how they all work, and the unique pros and cons of each one, I think we'll see some musicians that think it's total BS and will just prefer to write music the good old-fashioned way. And I think we'll see more musicians probably still write music the good old-fashioned way, but use these tools as supplementary or complementary to do certain very specific things for their music. Like, for instance, I met up with a girl last week. She's 16 years old. She's from a small town in Texas, and she reached out to me. She was coming to LA with her father, and she said, I just wrote my first AI, there's no way. This guitar sounds amazing. And she goes, oh, no, the guitar is me. Everything else in the track is AI because I'm not very good at percussion. All right, well, then now she has this amazing pop track that she wouldn't have been able to do because she doesn't think she's good at percussion, but she did the guitar. So I think that was already a great use case or example of a 16-year-old figuring out how to fill in the gaps of her own limitations with artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Kevin Kelly always talks about the idea that, you know, the Mozarts and the Picassos and the Beethovens, they had to have their instrument before their genius was unlocked, right? And because we don't yet have many instruments, many different kinds of tools, there are many geniuses who have not yet been unlocked, right?
I love that. Yeah, that's great.
So true. So talk about, I think this is part of the album, right? Your blockchain song or your tokenized song. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. What does that mean for people who aren't familiar with any of that at all? Like, what does it mean to put a song on a blockchain?
It's so confusing. And honestly, that could mean 30 different things depending on who you talk to in the blockchain community. There are a lot of different blockchain technologies being applied to artistic endeavors and all kinds of things. But in this particular instance, the purpose of the experiment that I did was to figure out what happens when we can re-incentivize the creative community around collaboration. So I basically released a free token. I said, anyone who wants this token can get it. You just have to sign up with your Ethereum wallet address. So that was obviously a limiter to some extent. Anyone who didn't have one would have to figure that out. And in doing so, in signing up, they own an equal percentage of the back end of that song. So when that song goes live on iTunes, on Spotify, on any of the on any of the platforms that it's distributed through, all 500 people will own the same percentage of the back end of royalties for payment. And in also owning a piece of that song, I'm giving them, granting them collaborative access to be part of the creative process. So it's kind of like Patreon on stereo, or Kickstarter on steroids. Mm-hmm. Instead of just giving people a gift or something in exchange for them funding a project, they actually get to be a part of it from step one to step 10 and be financially incentivized, even if that's tiny or insignificant, as is the case with most music projects.
Yeah.
They're incentivized to share the song. If it is successful, what a cool kind of case. Mm-hmm. And while I may not be the best person to necessarily spearhead that experiment in all forms and fashions, other musicians, if you think about a really big musician that has the kind of huge audience and pull, might be really incentivized to work on that model because their music makes money and they would love to have the creative freedom to work away from the label system or work away from the advertising system and be fueled by their fans and by their fans alone. So it really just was an experiment to see what happens. And it's been super fun. I haven't released the track yet. Mm-hmm. It is finished. Mm-hmm. So we are just figuring out, and when I say we, I mean all my token holders. We're figuring out a fun marketing plan together right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what does that look like? Because the space between that and the conventional music industry is going to be really interesting, right? Like, so you're talking about distributing royalties or whatever. How does that work with this system?
It's not particularly easy. The music industry has made it as hard as possible for artists to be paid on their own, just as an individual on their music. Mm-hmm. There are so many different royalties and rights agencies. Even for this one song, we're not going to be able to collect all the royalties that are out there. A lot of times money just stays on the table because you can't sign up with the right agency or there's like, you don't have a publisher.
Yeah.
Rules. But for the most part for this project, we're able to take any of the royalties that come in to iTunes, Spotify, streaming, performance, and composition, and run them through a trust. And that trust then runs through this smart contract, which automatically sends out the micropayments on a quarterly basis to all of those wallet addresses.
Yeah.
So we kind of used an existing recognized legal entity to funnel this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Experiment.
Well, what do you think, like do you think that's a potential business model, like you said, for maybe established or big musicians to do? Or do you think we'll need to kind of develop an entirely new ecosystem of tools around that kind of stuff to make that accessible to people?
Both. YouTube was not considered a place where celebrities or even anyone with stature would go and put their content. Mm-hmm. And now, that's completely shifted and changed. So I think, huge artists are not incentivized to use that kind of platform and to run those kinds of experiments. But I think medium-sized artists, I think artists that were huge that have been disenfranchised from the institution that built them. And probably a lot of young up and coming artists that are just attracted to a new way of doing things will be excited about this. And the tools are there to do some of this. It's just not easy. It's clunky. There's a lot of paperwork involved.
Yeah.
There's no easy front end interface for any of this stuff, but in 2 to 3 years, I think there will be.
Yeah. So what about the, you've released a couple of music videos that are basically VR videos or 360 videos. What's that like? How does that differ from, like, I don't even know the equipment necessary. And I feel like, some of it was live and some of it looked like it was constructed, worlds. So what is the set of tools you're using there to make that happen?
Yeah, so the more recent pieces for my AI album have all been done in Game Engine. So like you said, they're constructed in worlds. And I have another one that I have not yet released that I'm really excited about. The sad thing is they're not the best to watch on YouTube. Mm-hmm. YouTube's 360 technology isn't great. The streaming quality's low. And most people who turn on a browser don't even have a browser that's compatible for watching in 360. Mm-hmm. So they end up watching like two squares that look disjointed and they're like, what is this? But yeah, for those videos, we're working with Google Blocks, with Google Tilt Brush, which are two pretty inexpensive, low cost entry VR consumer art platforms, kind of like the Photoshop of the VR world, to build out these crazy worlds that typically you'd have to use Maya or another really advanced animation engine to use. And this really came out of I found a couple of scrappy young artists that work in the VR space and had figured out how to build these worlds using just, you know, their little VR, what do you call them, the controller tilt brush brushes that look designed as if they were designed in an animated software system. Yeah. So we use those, we built out these worlds, and then you can import those worlds into Unity and take a 360 camera, rig it through basically you're rigging a fake camera in a fake world, and then that camera is capturing all the information, and then, I mean, you might know all of this, but in case if any of your viewers don't, capturing all that information, and then we make a video out of it. With the live stuff, that's so much easier. it's literally just a single camera that you prop up in the middle of a room and it captures everything around it.
Yeah. Well, you said that, you know, it's hard to, the platform for kind of viewing is not really there very, very much, right? So when I've seen your videos pop up on like a web page or something like that, I can click and drag in the YouTube player and, you know, and move around. But it's not obvious that you could do that, right? Like you have to know
you have to
that that's what's
know.
Going on. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom called me after I released the first video and she goes, "Honey, everything is black." I'm like, "Mom, are you pointing at the ground?" Oh.
There you go. Yeah.
I'm like, and my mom knows it's VR, so
right.
I don't know what that says. I think only about 7 people have actually watched those videos, including you, the way that they were intended to be watched.
Well, that's the danger of putting agency in the hand of your audience. They don't know where to go, right?
So that's also YouTube's fault. We can blame it on that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that's something I thought a lot about because moving into that art form is tricky because you're trying to both focus the user's attention and also allow them to have a little bit of choice in what they're focusing on, right? How do you think about that when you're trying to construct these things? You know, like what's the thought process there in terms of how much do you want to balance guiding the users versus just kind of letting them have free rein to, you know, look at the ground or whatever.
In the case of the music videos, to be honest, we were severely limited just by budget and time. And so in working with the constraints we had, we pretty much decided early on that we would focus the viewer's attention quite heavily towards one corner of the room and not do anything else anywhere else that would be distracting. So we do have, I mean, in some of the shots, there are 360 degree vistas or views, or, I mean, you can see like an epic landscape, but it's nothing interesting enough. We keep all the character action happening in one small frame of the screen. We also did that for the YouTube viewer, knowing that a lot of people were going to be watching this on a desktop computer, would have no idea that they can move around and see inside the video. If we keep all the action within a narrow window, at least they get to see most of what's going on versus making it larger than life. They'll miss all of it. Mm-hmm. So that was that. Those were conscious decisions we made given the limitations of the platform and the realities of what we had to work with.
Yeah. Well, I wonder about that in terms of just VR adoption in general, because that's, it's so much harder to paint a three-dimensional world just in terms of narrative and you know, framing the experience, and then to have that potentially, you know, you'll do something over in a corner and nobody will catch it, right? Like, yep. Do something interesting. So that strikes me as a real problem for adoption, because it's going to be really hard to make these interesting stories, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's maybe something similar there with like 3D movies, you know, which are much more common now than they were several years ago. But, you know, one of the things there is, you know, I don't think people knew how to tell stories with 3D. So it just seemed like a kind of gimmick or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how VR feels a lot for people. I mean, I think, I don't know if VR will transform storytelling as much as it could transform experience. Mm. So, I mean, I think taking a really great story in 2D and not reinventing the wheel, but just figuring out how to take that story and put it in VR in a way that enhances the emotion, enhances the feeling of being there, but isn't distracting, isn't like, honestly, I actually think some of the really interactive stuff in some ways is less interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe because I'm just so accustomed to more passive viewing, but I kind of just want to be taken to another world.
Yeah.
And that may be all VR is. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it's like it's why going to the theater, I think, feels a bit more epic than watching a movie in your living room. You've got a black box surrounding you, so you're not distracted by the devices and the kids and the dog and the.
Right.
And that's what VR does, just in an even more intense way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is something to that. Like, I feel like going to the movie theater is the best. Or the closest thing I get on a regular basis to meditation, right? Something that like zones your focus so intently.
Right? Yeah, and, I love that we're in that in this day and age where that is true. That the theater is as close to we'll get to meditation. It's true with all the notifications and the constant insanity of our lives.
Yeah. Well, so that's something I'm curious about, how, you know, as someone who's very engaged with social media, how do you personally deal with it? And do you get, you know, notifications all day long, or, you know, how do you manage all that kind of stuff?
I have adopted an opt-in only approach to all of my social media behaviors, which means I only see the message, I only see the replies by physically going to that website and checking in. I check on my phone, on my desktop. Even my email is push only. So I have to physically. No, that doesn't stop me from pushing every 30 minutes during my workday. But it does become a more conscious decision of when I want to have the world enter my space.
Yeah.
I don't allow the world in on its own, on its own accord, because it will drive you insane. And I know this from having been so active in the early and being one of the first kids sort of figuring this world out. There were not that many people on Twitter when I started tweeting 10 years ago, and MySpace was the first thing I was on, and then Instagram. And I mean, it just became, we didn't have any rules and no one was telling us the right or wrong way to do it. And so I think there was a ton of burnout in the content creator community, and we learned a lot of really hard lessons. Some people are are better at dealing with it than others, but for me, I can't do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've had to create some pretty hard line rules for myself.
Yeah.
To stay happy and at peace with my with my world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's I have gone back and forth on this because a lot of people, you know, are like, I don't want any notifications. I don't want anything to like interrupt my processes. But for me, it's almost just as frustrating to be like, maybe something has happened, mm-hmm. right? Like maybe something mm-hmm. has come in, right? Maybe something, mm-hmm. some kind of negatively life-changing email has arrived, right?
Right.
Something like that. You know, so that's a real, like, it's a real dangerous behavior, or it's a dangerous, kind of dynamic. You know, I don't know a good answer.
The FOMO of being on all the time, and the FOMO of not being on all yeah. the time. It's a real
yeah.
thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is part of, as our society kind of develops, we get all kinds of new possibilities, and this is something that technology does, and we have to develop all kinds of new responsible ways of handling it that we didn't have before. Like, and mm-hmm. I think about this when I was growing up as a kid, my mom didn't let me have sugary cereal, right? But as an adult, I could eat a pound of sugar every day and nobody would stop me, right? And so, I could have all the candy I wanted, right? And so as an adult, I have to learn how to make those decisions that I didn't have to make as a kid. And it's the same situation here. We have like all this possibility of just kind of, filling our minds with all kinds of stuff, and developing our own sort of responsible approach to that is really difficult, I think.
Self-restraint. It's a hard thing to master. Mm-hmm. and knowing what's good for us. Sometimes yeah. it feels really good in the yeah. moment.
Mm-hmm.
We don't recognize the long-term effects.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's a real thing. This is why, like, for me, it's so important to talk about and think about the future, because the decisions that we're making right now that seem great, whether it's political or social or whatever, those could easily not be great, right? And our ability to decide between those things in some sense depends on our ability to conceive of a future that's different than now.
Mm-hmm. Well said, Micah.
Sorry. I'm supposed to be interviewing you, not going on.
It's great. I should have written that down so I could take it for another interview.
You can use that. Yeah. I know you've talked about, in some of your videos about the ways that some of these technologies can be used for good. I know you had like something with virtual reality, and I think children who are experiencing a lot of pain, something like that.
Terminally ill kids, yeah.
Yeah, talk about that more. How did that help them? What's the potential there?
Transformative experience. Not all that dissimilar from doing ayahuasca in the forest, yeah, really. Yeah. I mean, I think what we're learning so much more about now is embodiment and what mm-hmm. that means, and technology giving a sense of embodiment, and mm-hmm. how brilliant our bodies are at tricking us in all kinds of clever ways mm-hmm. to experience pain, to not experience pain. So we've typically used medication for that, but we're finding through a ton of research being done at top tier universities that virtual reality can offer patients such a hyper realistic view of another world that their bodies think they're in another world mm. and shut off pain receptors. Mm-hmm. So you can have kids getting their chemo treatment or, you know, smaller procedures that don't require general anesthesia. They can receive VR as a treatment. Mm-hmm. And their pain receptors go down just as much as morphine or codeine or whatever mm-hmm. whatever else they're being prescribed. So that's super promising.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic. I feel like those kinds of uses are not what people think of or focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of, I mean, you know, this goes to, I guess, how we talk about technology in general. A lot of it's the negatives or the, you know, the people getting sucked into unreal things, so forth. Do you think that's a cultural problem? Like, does our culture need to change how it approaches things like that? Or is there a good reason for us to kind of have popular culture focused on the negative and scary aspects of technology?
I mean, gosh, I don't know if you can ever get rid of the fear of something new. Mm-hmm. We are creatures of habit. Mm-hmm. And it is really hard to change our ways, and particularly as we get older and the brain becomes less plastic, mm-hmm. And we become more entrenched in our beliefs and our ways of doing things, it just becomes harder to introduce new concepts, new ideas. And so I don't know if it's possible. I certainly think it's Hollywood's responsibility to start telling better stories. I mean, they're supposed to be the imaginative ones. So mm-hmm. if they're truly being imaginative, let's hear some more optimistic, beautiful visions for the future that incorporate interesting ideas in novel new ways. So I'd love to see entertainment get a little bit more creative. What's the opposite of Black Mirror? You mm-hmm. know, like,
yeah.
what can we see that's not The Handmaid's Tale,
yeah.
But utilizes technology in interesting ways? And then I think, if we could, this is just an idealist's view of how we educate our children, but I think especially coming into a world where they're going to be graduating and half of the jobs that their parents told them they should be looking at just 5 years ago won't even exist because of AI. I mean, I think really looking at re-educating kids to have a very flexible, adaptive mindset about the world around them, about technology, about their own skill sets and how they can adapt and change is probably the most important skill they could be learning. And I think that that will inevitably shift mm-hmm. mindsets a bit to be more open-minded about how we adopt this stuff. But I understand, I mean, I understand the fears that people have, and I think that some of it is very valid. We've got to be careful and cautious about how we go about adopting any kind of technology, but
yeah.
that doesn't stop it.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, and the fear stance doesn't, like you said, doesn't stop it, and doesn't necessarily help us figure out a better way to engage with it.
That's right. It almost sometimes the fear conversations, while I honor them in people, they go on a little too long. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, all right, and now let's get to a more useful conversation, mm-hmm. A more pragmatic conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That your point about the kind of creative or lack of creativity of the movie industry, you know, in particular, like, I think about that because, yeah, those stories need to be told, those kind of dystopian stories where it's like, you know, it looks good on the outside, but underneath it's, you know, it's a terrible reality, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to look out for that. But in many ways, I feel like that's just recapitulating World War II. Like, we've done that, those kind of dystopian scenarios so many times. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't know any other stories, you know?
I know. There has to be bad guys, and the bad guys have to be the future.
Yeah, right.
Right. You know, the good guys just want to keep things as they are.
Right. Yeah.
They just want to embrace everything that makes us human.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's human always ends up changing. None of us respect mm-hmm. A lot of the ideas that we once held to be so true and strong for ourselves. Mm. 300, 400, 500 years ago, mm-hmm. we would actually look at a lot of those beliefs around what it means to be human and be shocked and disheartened.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think it means to be human, or how would you even approach that question?
Oh, man. Dang it. That's a hard one. I mean, I'm going to give you some really ambiguous, open-ended answer, which is just that I think it could mean honestly anything. I mean, we have the most incredible vessel of any creature on this earth in our ability to comprehend and what's the word I'm looking for? Synthesize information in ways that other species cannot.
Yeah.
And we could create literally anything out of that. And we've chosen to make this world, this physical world. I'm looking outside at four concrete buildings, and I'm like, really, that's the best we could do? So I don't know. I kind of feel like it could be whatever we wanted it to be, but it's, you know, we're conditioned off of so many years of culture and ideas, and so we're kind of stuck in this one idea. But I'm pretty open. I mean, I'm on this podcast, so if I felt really strongly about one identity of humanity, then I might not. But I don't know what it means. I'm drawn to the creative and the artistic and the expression, and that's fun for me, and the emotion. And the ups and the downs and like the beauty of all of it. So I suppose I'm probably a bit more biased toward a vision that has all of those things and less interested in a like robotic human existence. But maybe there are people that really love that. Like, I think of technology as being an enabler to all of these other things. But if someone wants to be a binary robot, with little creativity, then to each their own.
Right. Yeah. Well, like you said, you know, the concrete buildings out your window, this is the world we've constructed. Is that what we want? Or I think that's how people conceptualize technology, is concrete, steel. You know, you think of like a cyborg, right? And all of that to me, and I think part of the reason why we fear it or we draw back from some of those visions is because it looks like aesthetic failure, right? Like, you don't call somebody a cyborg who has contact lenses or, you know, artificial parts that work. You know, you call them a cyborg when it doesn't work very well, right?
Yeah.
So I think we need those, you know, more organic kind of technological visions of, well, maybe we could do something other than just make everybody have steel arms, or, you know, make a world of more concrete or something like that. But again, that's tough. 100%. Like, that's the storytelling issue. That's the hard part, right?
Yeah, no. And that's why I'm getting into the filmmaking side.
Yeah.
So I can tell more of those stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. So you put up a video of yourself going through a process to freeze your stem cells. Talk about why you would do that. Is that something other people should do? What are your thoughts on that?
So it's early days, right? Which means that I might have done something that turns out to be utterly useless. In doing this, however, I think that for me, the opportunity cost was greater not to. There are so many trials being done currently with stem cells from bone marrow, as well as fat, although bone marrow has shown to have better results in a lot of those cases. So I guess just to back up a little bit, I was contacted by this company. I'd heard of some other people who had gone and done this. I'm really interested in the longevity space, and pretty much anything I could do now to optimize for a longer, healthier life, I'm willing to do it. And I was never like a biohacker. I was never really good about my health. Like, I don't work out. I eat like crap. I was just eating two pieces of processed string cheese. But at the same time, I drink wine almost every night. You know, like, I do everything wrong. But I love life. And I would really like it to continue as long as possible and as healthy as possible. And so in my mind, in some ways, stem cells were probably my way of alleviating the guilt that I feel over not being better about with my own health, and hoping that, you know, if these things really do turn out to be really helpful, particularly in fighting you know, an onset of disease, because that once that happens, game over. Like, you're, unless if you can manage to survive and beat whatever it is that's ailing you, you're at the very least signing up for months, if not years, of pain and exhaustion and I mean, depending on what we're talking about, whether it's cancer or a debilitating blood disease, whatever it might be, I would just really be upset if I could have had the possibility of using these stem cells. And of course, as you get older, those stem cells degrade over time. So it just felt like, all right, why not do it now while I'm youngish? Mm-hmm. I'm still young, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's as good a time as ever. So I did it, and I'm happy I did it. It was painful. Mm-hmm. I thought it was more painful than I thought it would be. Although they tell me that most people don't have an issue with it, so it could be that I just have sensitive bones. Mm. But as to whether or not I would recommend it to someone else, I think that depends on their pain tolerance and that depends on their financial situation. It's not cheap, although it's still a lot cheaper than it was 2-3 years ago. I think the price will continue to go down, and it will just become more and more affordable over the next few years. That would be my general consensus as to whether or not this is something the general public should be doing.
Well, and is this something, if you got a disease or something like that tomorrow, is this something they could do things with now, or is it kind of more like banking on a future possibility, a future technology?
So currently, if you have an injury, a sustained injury, like a broken arm or a bad sprain or strain in your ankle, stem cells are currently being used on high performing athletes and have been used for 10, I think, I don't want to get the wrong facts, send out the wrong facts, but I think over 10 years and with great success. Mm-hmm. So there are certain applications that you can currently use those stem cells for. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some of the things that are being done in clinical trials, they need a bit more time before they get the FDA approval, but that's probably nearer than you think. Some of these are in stage 3 mm-hmm. clinical trials. So I don't know the full list, and I'm hoping I don't have to in the next 5 years. But I've got some time. A lot of these diseases don't come on until later, mm-hmm. later onset, age-related senescence of cells. So we're talking about, I've got hopefully like 20, 30 years before I have to start worrying about some of this.
Yeah. So you said you were really interested in the longevity space. A lot of people have mixed feelings about it, you know, like what would I do with all that time? Like those kinds of things. Like what's your take on that? Or how do you feel about those kinds of questions?
I've never understood it because, like I told you earlier, I can find anything to do with time. It's a fault of mine. I mean, I find the world endlessly fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I just wish I had more time, mm-hmm. always. Because I don't know. One day I'm researching cat food, and I could find that really interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I thought of that, because I was really researching cat food yesterday for my cat, thinking, you know, I never really took it upon myself to learn about what's in cat food. And perhaps what's in her cat food is impacting her fur quality, and perhaps that's impacting my allergies, and maybe I should learn about this. And I went down like a 2-hour wormhole learning about cat food, and there was a tremendous amount of fascinating information.
Yeah.
So what would I do with more time? I would probably learn a lot more things. Mm. But that requires an able body and mind to care enough to be engaged in the world. Mm-hmm. And I also understand that not everyone is like interested in Googling everything. Mm-hmm. Like that's cool too. And that's fine for them. And if they want to die early and they're happy with that, then that's great. But for me, I would just love to keep it going until I decide I'm kind of done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So this, I'm going to connect two things here. On one of your videos, you talked about how basically, you know, 90%, maybe more of the things that you try fail. The creative experiments, something like that. And so this to me seems like one of the biggest obstacles to both doing interesting things and to living indefinitely, right? Like, what you're talking about is going through, you know, millions more failures, right? Like, that's part of the process. How do you, how have you been able to try these things, experience failure, and come back from it so many times? And I mean, that seems really resilient. And I think that's one of the things that maybe separates people who do really cutting edge things from people who don't. So it's, what's your secret?
All right. So I can give you I'm going to give you two different answers to this, because I think that they're both right and I think that they're both wrong. And one is that it is a matter of grit and persistence and consistency, that like the small wins over time add up to equal big wins in the long run. And people often forget that, and they look at the big losses as like the, you know, as the sign that they shouldn't continue doing what they're doing. And that's huge. I mean, really, and I've seen it here in LA particularly, because this is the city of dreamers. Like, everyone comes here right off the back of a small town bus with stars in their eyes.
Yeah.
And a lot of people can't last more than a year, because there's no map to making it. And we're seeing that more and more across all careers, not just entertainment careers, but just, it's really hard to figure out how to pave a path for yourself. And so as much as I would say it's grit and consistency and acknowledging the small wins, and the small wins have to be there, by the way. I honestly wouldn't tell anyone to keep doing something after 6 years of all losses. That just means that maybe they should try something else. But if there are small wins, then I think it's good to acknowledge those. But I think on the other side of the coin is maybe something that is a bit more nuanced and hard to put in a motivational quote book. And that's, and I think that's people who can, how do I want to say this? I think it's being able to properly manage your own risk portfolio, your life risk portfolio, and that allocation, if you will, of investment, whether that's capital, time, your age, your responsibilities that you have. Do you have kids? Are you married? Like, that portfolio looks different for every person. And I think some people are just better at managing that risk portfolio. And that takes like taking a really strategic look at your life and your mindset, where you're at, where you live, and being smart. Like, sometimes it just comes down to being smart. When I first moved to LA, this was part luck and part just, I suppose, being smart, but like, I managed to find this friend that had this crazy apartment deal, and it was not the best living situation in the sense that I was underneath a pool that could crack at any time, and it was considered a hazard by the city of LA. But in doing so, she was able to get poverty level housing prices on this apartment that I could have died in, right? Yeah. But I guess at 20 years old, feeling invincible about life, I was willing to take the risk to pay Wichita level rent prices to live in LA. And I did that for 3-4 years. And I was able to take more calculated risks in my career because of my living situation. Not saying it was the best decision in the long run, but I made that choice, and it definitely made an impact on my ability to do things a certain way. Whereas people who are really strapped and up against, you know, the paycheck to paycheck, that's tougher. So if I look back and I seriously analyze all my choices, I would say I probably made some calculated choices that were helpful. In being able to take risks in other areas.
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, that rings true to me, right? That people who are able to spend enough time or energy on certain efforts have made big sacrifices elsewhere, right? And with in your case, it was being willing to live underneath something that could, yeah, that could fall in on you.
And by the way, do you know what it sounds like to go to bed under a whirlpool?
I do not know. Yeah, I do not know. I imagine that would be an interesting experience. Yes.
But those are risks that you do at 20 years old. You know, I probably lived on ramen noodles for a year too. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't be willing to do that now.
Yeah.
So I think it's like acknowledging some of those things. And I remember even saying to myself, you know what, Taryn, you're 21. You can suck it up and deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I kind of knew that at some point in my life, I might not be as willing to suck it up because I'd probably get older and more tired. And that was accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to me. This is what I wonder about. If part of what you need to do while you're young is to reach a sort of escape velocity, right? Like to do those kinds of crazy things that put you outside of your comfort zone enough. So, you know, whether it's moving to LA or living underneath a whirlpool or whatever, like that, that put you, on a different trajectory, right? Because yeah, it is hard. If you hadn't moved and stayed in Kansas, maybe things wouldn't have gone the same way, right? Like it would have been probably a lot harder to do that like now, right? Like, so you know, having to even trying to find a whirlpool that you could live under might be harder now than it used to be.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, so I'll put up links to your website, which I know has some of your songs and music videos. I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the releases from that and the documentary. What else should people kind of look for to track what you're doing and keep up with where things are?
That's mainly it for now. The album will be out in September, as well as the film will be finished in September, so probably out sometime next year. But after the album's done, I'm excited to actually get back into making some video content, but around the future tech space. So I think stuff that your listeners might be into, just exploring fun things like stem cells, and hopefully do so in some more creative, unique ways to get people talking and thinking about technology. As I said, in the non-dystopian version. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I'll put those links up, and definitely I'd recommend people to go check out those videos. And thanks so much, Taryn, for doing this. And maybe we'll talk more when the rest of your projects come out. I would love to do that. So.
Great. Anyway, thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk later.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye.